Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. You're listening to 101.5 on your FM dial. You've tuned in to us to hear a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And we're going to entertain you, inform you, and I don't know how much we're going to amuse you today, but you never can tell. What's funny to one person isn't to another. But did you know that the Northern Lights will be getting even better next year? Those people who are on the hunt for an exciting Northern Lights display may be in luck this winter thanks to changing solar winds. Next year and the year after might be even better in terms of aurora borealis activity and brightness. It all starts with the sun. Similar to how a cup of tea on a windowsill shows steam in the light, the sun has a constant stream of particles coming off of it. And this is known as the solar wind. That's what really drives the aurora. The two main ingredients for the aurora are one, solar wind, and two, the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field captures that solar wind, and from there, after a few other processes, the world gets the aurora borealis. And if you're in the southern hemisphere, the aurora australis. Here's where this year comes into play. The sun also has a magnetic field that reverses every 11 years. As the sun does that, the solar wind starts to change. And during that change, sometimes the wind can come out in big bursts. These are known as coronal mass ejections or solar storms. What that means is that during those periods when it's changing, you actually get the best conditions for aurora, because you get these storms that come through to us. And while the sun is reversing its magnetic field, it also gets what are called sunspots, those dark spots on the sun, which are related to the areas where solar storms come off of the sun. Periods with more sunspots can translate into very active and bright auroras. We're starting to get a few sunspots again. And now we're starting to see not only the regular aurora, but also these storms that come along, and that's what makes people so excited. In 2019 and in 2020, tourists who went to Alaska seeking out the aurora may have been disappointed. But by 2024 or 2025, there should be aurora every 2 to 3 days over the central part of Alaska, plus many more large storms, which means the aurora should be easier to view farther south in places like the southern part of Alaska into southeastern Alaska, and for people to the south. Well, when a solar storm starts to come off of the sun, these particles take about 3 days to get to Earth. If the solar wind is slow and thin, usually you just go to bed. But if all else fails, you can also turn to other places on the internet. And the social media will be full of testimonies about what the aurora looks like in the moment. So don't give up if you're not seeing aurora in your location. But go on the internet and check social media for the information of the moment. Aurorasaurus, put together by NASA scientists, maps out where people are seeing the lights. And visiting that site can be helpful to figure out if you're in the right area at the right time. So that is Aurorasaurus. That's AuroraSaurus. That's the site that you want to check. And good luck. I hope you see those shimmering curtains of color in the atmosphere. Following up the Northern Lights, we're going over to Asia, and we're going to look at China's military buildup. China is testing hypersonic missiles and building new nuclear missile silos. Just what is China up to? What has China been doing? Already in possession of the world's largest fighting force of some 2.2 million troops, China has begun pouring resources into its nuclear arsenal. While it long had about 20 silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and some 200 warheads overall as a nuclear deterrent, new satellite images show China has been rapidly building hundreds of more silos to potentially fill with nuclear missiles. The Pentagon believes its warheads will double to 400 in the next decade. That's on top of a weapons construction spree that has seen China's Navy exceed that of the U.S. in terms of number of ships, although many of them are smaller, less potent vessels. While China's Air Force has built some 200 advanced J-16 fighter jets and J-20 stealth jets in the past 6 years. Its latest military budget of $200 billion is some 7% higher than the previous years, and three times those of the number three and number four countries, India and Russia. To flex its new muscles, China recently sent 150 planes into Taiwan's air defense zone. encircled Japan with its warships. They're clearly challenging us regionally, according to General Mark Milley, who is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And their aspiration is to challenge the United States globally. Yes, but why now? The buildup is the work of President Xi Jinping, who set a goal of 2049 for China to be able to fight and win a major war with the US. Xi has made the restoration of Chinese sovereignty over all its former lands a top priority and a unifying theme for the nation's citizens. Textbooks focus on China's past military humiliations and assert the need for strength. The country sees itself surrounded in the Pacific by the US, its allies of Japan and South Korea and Taiwan and the Philippines. Xi said in 2018 that China cannot lose even one inch of territory left behind by our ancestors. And since then, China has crushed Hong Kong's autonomy and warned that reunification with Taiwan must be fulfilled by force if necessary. Because the US intends to build up its forces in the Pacific by 2030, some people believe China might invade Taiwan in the next 5 years. But right now, the US military is still vastly more powerful than China's. But China is attempting to get ahead in new technologies such as hypersonic missiles. But China does have weaknesses. The main criticism of China's military is that while it has invested in flashy hardware, its troop training is weak, and the soldiers operating the weapons are inexperienced. Corruption and an outdated command structure have left a very negative impact on the army. Some analysts believe that China's one-child policy, the former one-child policy that was repealed in the past few years, has left it with soldiers reluctant to leave their parents without descendants. China's military has seen almost no combat since 1979, and its various armed forces have little experience working together. With that, we should talk about the U.S. military advantage. The U.S. still has by far the world's biggest and most experienced military, as well as the most powerful and advanced nuclear arsenal. Its 1.5 million soldiers have been fighting nearly continuously for the past 20 years. The various forces have a lot of experience working in close coordination, something that cannot be said for China. Well, what about China's allies? What are the countries that ally with China? China's only formal ally is North Korea, which has nuclear weapons but is desperately poor. But ever since China launched its first joint exercise with Russia in 2003, those countries' two militaries have been cooperating more and more. And in the past few months, that partnership has increased even more so. This past August, some 10,000 Chinese and Russian troops carried out war games in north central China to test the new weapon systems. In October, they conducted elaborate joint naval exercises, which involved 10 warships that menaced Japan and simulated attacks on U.S. submarines. While Moscow and Beijing have no mutual defense treaty, they do have the common aim of containing the U.S. Both countries see themselves as being surrounded. And a war against both simultaneously obviously would be nightmarish. So ever since the U.S. pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2001, an arms race has been effectively underway with Russia and China. Beijing shows no interest in arms control talks, so continued buildups on all sides are likely. And the more weapons, the greater the likelihood of purposeful or inadvertent use. Meanwhile, China's ambition to absorb Taiwan is clear. If China does attack, the worst case is a conventional war spiraling out of control and escalating into a nuclear exchange. Hello again, it's me. It's time now for some questions and answers, questions submitted to the scientists at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And these are questions that people have been thinking about, and so they've gone to the experts for the answers. The first question is, what is the earliest record of humans thinking about an afterlife? And in response, the people at the Smithsonian say, written records are full of beliefs about the afterlife, from reincarnation to resurrection, but they date back only about 5,000 years at most. There's no way of knowing prehistoric people's thoughts. Beliefs do not fossilize. But starting between 100 and 130,000 years ago, Homo sapiens living in what is now Israel buried people with items like animal bones and seashells and ochre pigment, perhaps because they thought the deceased could use those items in the next world. But these relics might simply show that early humans honored and grieved their loved ones, something other primates like chimpanzees have also been shown to do. And then there's another question. This is, what is the rarest item in the Smithsonian Institution collection, and how is it obtained? Well, it's impossible to single out the rarest treasure in a collection of 155 million items, but many other objects have incredible acquisition stories. For instance, when the first gold nugget was found in California in early 1848, members of the U.S. Army brought it back to Washington, D.C. for testing. And in December 1848, President James K. Polk formally announced the discovery, launching the gold rush. The Smithsonian inherited the nugget in 1861. And the lesson is, small item huge consequences. I know you've just been thinking about this and this topic and its condiments and the origin of condiments. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about mustard and maybe soy sauce. But with mustard, using the seeds from the Brassica juicea plant as seasoning dates at least back to 3000 BC in Sumeria and in India. The Sumerians were likely the first to grind them into a paste. King Tut was buried with a passel of the seeds to spice up the afterlife. The Romans mixed the ground seeds with wine and created a tart sauce that we might recognize today. The sauce was later called Mustum Ardens, Latin for burning wine, and later it was shortened to mustard. And so that was the Brassica juicea plant. And now for soy sauce. One of soy sauce's main forerunners was a flavorful Chinese paste known as Jiang, which emerged before 256 BC and was made with fermented meat and fish or grain. Sometime around AD 960 to 1279, Jiang Yu appeared, a more watery condiment made by boiling and fermenting soybeans in brine. And by the 17th century, Japanese say that soy sauce, called soyu, was predecessor of the English term and had evolved into one quite similar to the liquid that is found in the kitchen today. And so there you have the origin of several of our favorite condiments. And now, as we near the end of today's show, we're going to have just a little bit of wit and wisdom, some quotations from people who are famous and some who are not so famous. But Mel Brooks, you know him, he said, "Laughter is a protest scream against death." And the poet Marianne Moore said, "The passion for setting people right is in itself an afflictive disease." Comedian Fred Allen of the past said, "A conference is a gathering of important people who singly can do nothing, but together can decide that nothing can be done." And then novelist Anne Lamont said, "Not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and then waiting for the rat to die." Think about that. And George Orwell, the author, said, "At 50, everyone has the face he deserves." I don't know about that. And then Alfred Hitchcock gave us this quotation: "The length of a film should be directly related to the endurance of the human bladder." And finally, Dashiell Hammett, who was the writer of many detective stories, said, "The problem with putting two and two together is that sometimes you get four and sometimes you get 22. And that, my friends, brings us to the part of the program where I have to say goodbye. And I want you to tune in again, 101.5 on your FM dial. Please come and visit us for a little of this, a little of that, because we seek to entertain, to inform, and occasionally to amuse you. So you take care, stay healthy, be kind to each other. It'd be a much nicer world if you can do that. And now it's time for Willie Nelson, my good friend in travels, to take us down the road again as we look for some more material for a little of this and a little of that. You have a good day, a good week, and I'll be back soon. Bye-bye.